Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Copyright 2006 by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. In the last episode, it was still early in the case of the disappearance of Amy St. Laurent, and the investigators were gathering information on the missing woman. We resume Finding Amy with Episode 4 on page 37. As the inquiry expanded to include a closer look at Amy St. Laurent, her home, her family, and her co-workers, the number of key players on the investigative side also expanded. From the moment Danny Young had received a phone call about the missing South Berwick woman, the Portland detectives had anticipated that another complication would soon arise: the jurisdictional challenges of which police agencies would be involved in conducting the investigation, and the question of who would be in charge. Amy St. Laurent was last seen alive in Portland, but that didn't necessarily make Portland the site of the crime. Her home was 40 miles away in South Berwick. Her house and car needed to be searched, along with the area around her house. With no definitive crime scene or confirmation of any actual crime, police would need to spread a wide net. If someone, Rubright, Gorman, or someone not yet identified, took St. Laurent in a car, she could be anywhere. Maine is a largely rural state. Outside the larger cities and towns, the public safety functions are performed by county sheriff's departments and the state police. Except in Bangor and Portland, which are authorized by the Attorney General's office to conduct their own investigations, the Maine State Police, MSP, handle all homicide investigations. Police organizations often need to work together to solve crimes, but police are also very territorial and wary about sharing authority, control, and sensitive information. Even in a case like this, where everyone wanted to cooperate, cooperation could be extremely complicated. Different law enforcement organizations participating in the search for Amy St. Laurent would have different command structures and different investigative approaches, different systems for keeping records and writing reports, and different protocols and SOPs for sharing that information. Even their radios couldn't automatically talk to each other. There were also the natural tensions between police agencies. The edgy rivalry between local police departments and the state police begins at the academy level. For many years, all police officers in Maine trained together at the Maine Police Academy, except state police, who trained at their own facility. Their facility had a longer training course, and right from the start there was an assumption that longer must be better. Although both state police and local police now train together for part of the time, the traditional sense of inferiority-superiority lingers, often exacerbated by the fact that in most jurisdictions, when the state police arrive, they come to take over. There was also the practical reality. No cop wanted to put his heart and soul into an investigation that might be jerked out from under him tomorrow. And the best homicide detectives absolutely do put their hearts and souls into their work. For now, Joyce and Young were cool with the need for cooperation. They could work out the details later. Right now, they had a missing woman, a worried family and friends, and a community on alert. They had one set of priorities, and only one: to find Amy St. Laurent as quickly as possible, and, if she had indeed been the victim of foul play, to identify and arrest the person responsible. The state police arrived in the form of Detective Sergeant Matthew Stewart, Sergeant Joyce's counterpart from MSP Criminal Investigation Division 1, which covers most of southern Maine, including Amy St. Laurent's hometown of South Berwick. Although they were both admitted control freaks and extremely territorial, Stewart and Joyce could hardly have been more different. Despite hair so closely cropped that its color was undiscernible, Sergeant Stewart, with his smart suits, gold-rimmed glasses, and shiny shoes, looks more like a banker or a lawyer than a cop. Although he is not the tall, hulking presence many state troopers are, Stewart has plenty of that innate, if difficult to describe, quality the police call command presence. His demeanor is reserved and taciturn, but when he chooses to be, Sergeant Stewart is extremely charming. Because his job frequently thrusts him in front of the media, and because cops, particularly detectives, are deeply cautious about the careless word or inadvertent slip, Stewart has become an expert wordsmith. He likes to weigh his words before he speaks, and the sentences he finally parts with are masterpieces of verbal construction. He says he has had to acquire the skill of saying something without really saying anything when speaking to the media. Recognizing that there was much to be done in and around St. Lawrence residence in South Berwick, Portland police cautiously welcomed Stewart's offer to take over part of the investigation. Sergeant Joyce was careful, however, to keep his people involved in any joint efforts to ensure continuity and quick access to new information. After a meeting to update the MSP detectives on the case, it was decided that the state police would concentrate on the South Berwick portion of the investigation. For the first week of the investigation, Sergeant Stewart assigned MSP detective Rick LeClaire to work with Danny Young. MSP detectives, sometimes accompanied by Portland police, conducted forensic searches of Amy St. Lawrence's apartment, as well as searches of the surrounding area. At that time, police did not know where or under what circumstances she had gone missing. It did not appear that she had made it back home, but until they could rule out that possibility, they had to treat the apartment as a potential crime scene. On Saturday, when St. Lawrence had been missing for a week, her mother, Diane Jenkins, asked if she could go to Amy's apartment to retrieve some personal items. The lock had been changed to control access, and the condition and contents of the house had been documented, photographed, and examined, but the police were not yet ready to release the apartment. Although he was supposed to be off that day, Sergeant Stewart agreed to meet Diane Jenkins there. It was the first time he had met Amy St. Lawrence's mother. What followed was an excruciating experience for everyone. Sergeant Stewart, a meticulous and cautious man colleagues describe as the kind of detective who is first to a crime scene and last to leave, was deeply troubled by the dilemma posed by Diane Jenkins' presence. Torn between his duty to preserve the scene, because any item might have evidentiary value, and compassion for the desperate mother's desire to touch her daughter's possessions. The dilemma was vividly played out as Amy's mother went from room to room, reaching out to touch clothes, jewelry, and other items in order to connect with Amy, wanting to feel and sometimes take away many of her daughter's things, while Sergeant Stewart felt he had to dissuade her from doing that. At one point, Diane Jenkins picked up her daughter's jacket, buried her face in it, and said, "It smells like her." As they left the apartment, Jenkins asked if anyone had checked the crawl space under the duplex to see if Amy might be there. Stewart assured her that the space had been checked during an earlier search, but recognizing from her forlorn and desperate look that she needed to put that possibility to rest, he crawled underneath with a flashlight. During searches of the apartment, police carried away Amy St. Lawrence's computer and her personal correspondence, her telephone answering machine. They even collected the bloody tissues from the bathroom wastebasket. Later, they would read her letters and her diary, a slender volume designated as the Diary of Amy Elizabeth St. Lawrence, which charted her struggles to find herself after her breakup with longtime boyfriend Richard Sparrow. Detectives would listen to her phone messages and read the email on her computer. They would contact her correspondents and her callers, checking names, relationships, and stories. Detectives examined the clothes in Amy's closet, including the pockets, looked through her dresser drawers. They would check her phone records to see whom she'd been calling, Learn about her spending habits from bank statements and credit card bills. To an outsider, it sounds terribly intrusive. After all, if something had happened to Amy St. Laurent, she was the one on whose behalf the police were working. But in a potential homicide case, the detective stands in the shoes of the victim and becomes her earthly representative. As Vernon Gieberth says, many times the detective ends up learning more about the deceased than the victim knew about him or herself. They learned that Amy St. Laurent had spent her earliest years in New Hampshire with her parents Diane and Dennis St. Laurent. When the marriage broke up, Amy lived briefly with her father, then went to live with her mother. Her mother subsequently married a man named Don Jenkins, and Amy and her younger sister Julie lived with them. They moved to South Portland in 1989. She attended South Portland High School. Although she was an honors student, she found high school unchallenging and perhaps, because she feared it would be more of the same, opted not to attend college. Later, Amy had become involved with Richard Sparrow. Amy and Sparrow lived together in various places for about 5 years, most recently in the apartment in South Berwick. At one point, they became engaged, but the engagement was later broken. At the time Amy disappeared, their relationship had been over for several months, but Sparrow was still listed on her credit cards, and they remained close friends. Part of the reason for the breakup was Amy's feeling that she was too young to settle down. Although she longed for a home and children, she'd always been involved in a relationship and wanted time to find herself before settling into something permanent. She and Sparrow felt that they had grown apart. She had become more career-oriented, while he was still content to drink beer and watch TV. She had long harbored a secret crush on a man named Jason Colias, whom she had met in high school when they both worked at a Dunkin' Donuts. His wife, who had been a good friend of hers, had died, leaving him with a small son, Jacob, of whom Amy was very fond. It had been on a trip to Florida to visit Jason and Jacob a few weeks earlier that Amy had met Jason's neighbor, Eric Rubright. Like many pretty girls in their mid-twenties, Amy longed to be taken more seriously for her intelligence and her skills. She was paying more attention to her wardrobe, learning to dress more professionally. She was excited about the challenges and responsibilities of her job. She was saving money toward buying a house, where she hoped to live someday with a husband and children. She exercised regularly and did yoga to help her manage stress. Amy had occasionally smoked pot and was a social drinker. Friends described her as spontaneous, but not impulsive. A bouncer in the Old Port, who had known Amy since high school, described her as the type of girl who could take care of herself. Someone who wouldn't impulsively go off with a stranger. She was careful. She was sensible. She was responsible. She had too much self-respect to take foolish chances. She carried mace in her purse. She was also good-hearted and generous and hated to hurt people's feelings. And she was used to viewing the world and men from within the safety of an established relationship. Although much of the picture they built of her came from other sources, the detectives got closest to Amy through her own words. On the day she broke up with Richard Sparrow, Amy started a diary. She began to chronicle her feelings, watching Sparrow's truck disappear after 5 years together, on a page headed, "This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it." The detectives watched her struggle to adjust to the loneliness of an empty house, yet taking pleasure in the way solitude made her more attuned to the world around her. Watching birds at her feeder, working in her flower garden, charting the changes in the summer sky. A summer thunderstorm reminded her of a night when the power went out and Sparrow cooked them noodles over a camp stove. Another storm ended with shimmering rainbows and booming thunder, and Amy mused about nature's way of beauty in destruction, likening it to an "I Love Jesus" bumper sticker on a tank. Reading her diary gave the detectives insight into the caring woman others had described. One day, Amy drove past her high school boyfriend crouched on the lawn beside his baby daughter. She wrote how she was glad she'd moved on, but would always retain love for him, how she longed to have a child of her own some day, and wondered how she would feel if Richard Sparrow had a child with someone else. And there was her diary entry after September 11th. After hoping America's response as a nation would not be more hatred and destruction, she asked, "If I died today, what would I regret most? I wish I had noticed all this beauty and tranquility around me before. What the hell was so captivating that I didn't see the spider spinning his web, didn't hear the crickets every night, didn't notice all the goodness and beauty around me?" It might have been her kind heart that got her into trouble on that last Saturday. Detectives knew that Amy had met Eric Rubright on a trip to Florida 3 weeks earlier. Amy spent some time with Rubright, who took her on a motorcycle ride and showed her places on the Gulf around Fort Myers, including Sanibel Island. When she returned to Maine, Rubright emailed, saying he'd never been to Maine and asking if he could visit her when he came to visit relatives in New York. He sent her roses. Amy was not romantically interested in Eric Rubright, but she appreciated the attention and didn't want to be unkind, so she agreed that he could come. At first, she was casual about the visit, but as the date approached, she expressed reservations to her mother, McElhaney, Sparrow, and others. In her diary, she wrote, "And he's pretty aggressive. Have to keep on my toes when he's around. Keep the defenses up." Detectives learned from the South Berwick police that they had had a call on Monday after Amy disappeared from Ruth McElhaney, Amy's next-door neighbor and co-worker at Pratt & Whitney. She had contacted the police because Amy's expensive coat was lying on the ground beside her car, and had been for some time. McElhaney had gotten their landlady to bring the key so that she could enter Amy's apartment and see if everything was all right. Although Amy's backpack was there, Amy clearly wasn't around. Ruth McElhaney told the South Berwick police that she was worried, in part because Amy had been afraid of a visitor from Florida she'd had over the weekend. On Friday night, McElhaney had been turning into their shared driveway when the visitor, Eric Rubright, came peeling out, very angry. Amy, standing outside watching, confided that Rubright was mad because she had dashed his hopes that they would have a sexual relationship. McElhaney said Amy hadn't wanted Rubright to visit, but was too nice to say no. Despite Amy's reservations, after discussions with her friends, she had felt she could manage the situation. The South Berwick officer, responding to McElhaney's call, found a note on Amy's door saying, "Where the F did you go?" From the description of what Amy St. Laurent had been wearing on the night she disappeared, it appeared that the decision to check out Portland's nightlife must have been spontaneous. In jeans, sweatshirt, and sneakers, Amy wasn't dressed for a night on the town. Information the detectives gathered suggested that over the course of that Saturday evening, Rubright had been making unwelcome advances to Amy, and she might have been worn down, irritated, and frustrated with him. She had been drinking, though witnesses varied widely in their views of whether she was intoxicated. They learned that her action in finding a dance partner when Rubright wouldn't dance was not unusual. When Amy had gone to the pavilion with Sparrow, she would find herself a partner if she wanted to dance, and he didn't. Detectives had Rubright's version of the facts. They had Gorman's version of the facts. They had located witnesses who had observed Amy, Rubright, and Gorman during the course of the evening. Now their challenge would be to imagine Amy's version. As information was developed, the detectives would do this imagining to develop theories about what had happened, constantly reassessing what they knew based on their suspects and on their increasingly deep knowledge of who Amy St. Laurent was. They would picture Amy going through Saturday evening, playing pool, buying Rubright pizza, going to find a dance partner since he didn't want to dance, stopping with Gorman and Sharma at the Iguana Bar, Amy at the Brighton Avenue apartment, increasingly uncomfortable as no party materialized, and her instincts told her she wasn't where she wanted to be. The detectives drove the dark streets she might have traveled, mentally following the car of one suspect or another down those same streets, imagining the clash of wills of a man intent on having sex who might have become enraged when he was refused, and an independent, capable woman who didn't intend to be anyone's victim. Chapter 5. By Wednesday, detectives had checked out Eric Rubright's story more fully, a perfect example of a small thing that tells a big story. Rubright's receipts from the convenience store in South Portland gave them both a location and a time of purchase. That, in turn, led them to a time-stamped surveillance camera tape that put Rubright at the store paying for gas and purchasing food and soda at 1:36 a.m. Neighbors confirmed that Rubright's car was at Amy's apartment on Sunday morning and that her coat, which Rubright said he had left on the hood of her car, was lying on the ground. The specifics of his suspiciously detailed story were checking out. Police had interviewed him twice and polygraphed him. With no reason to arrest him or detain him further, they had to let Rubright leave the state. On Wednesday, Rubright agreed to allow police to collect blood for DNA and hair samples. Evidence technician Kevin McDonald went with a detective to the airport and collected these before Rubright left. In the conference room, watching the videotape from the convenience store, detectives could see that it confirmed Rubright's story. Bruce Coffin, studying the tape, remembered thinking, "Wow, there he is, just like he said, but maybe the girl is still in the car." And questions still remained. Was it possible that after leaving the store, Rubright had driven back to Portland and re-encountered St. Laurent? Detectives drove the route Eric Rubright had taken from the Old Port parking garage to the convenience store, late at night as Rubright had, and back to the Old Port again. Later in the week, Detective Kevin Curran, an MSP trooper interviewing toll takers on the turnpike, located a female attendant at the Scarborough Exchange who remembered a heavy-set male matching Rubright's description, showing up at her booth early Sunday morning searching for change, and after coming up with only 15 cents, asking if he could please use the highway because it was the only route he knew to the house where he'd been staying. She was certain that this had happened around 2 a.m., as this was when she normally had a snack. Based on this timeline, it would have been practically impossible for him to have returned to Portland and picked up St. Laurent. Police also contacted the agency from which Rubright had rented the GMC Envoy and arranged to have any trash that had been collected from the vehicle saved. Before the vehicle was cleaned and returned to service, it was towed to police headquarters at 109 Middle Street, where it underwent a forensic examination by Portland evidence technicians. Crazy as it was, Rubright's story was checking out. Although police had to continue to entertain the outside possibility that Rubright was involved in Amy's disappearance, his timeline didn't mesh with what they knew about Amy's activities after she left the pavilion. By the time Gorman said he'd dropped Amy off back in the Old Port, Eric Rubright was talking his way onto the turnpike. Still, while Rubright's story was being checked, investigators searched around the convenience store, South Portland cemeteries, wooded areas, and roadsides along the route that he had taken, looking for Amy or her body, and drove from the pavilion to the turnpike entrance at night to check the timing. The detectives also had to check out Richard Sparrow's activities on the night that Amy St. Laurent disappeared. Despite the breakup, he had maintained a presence in St. Laurent's life. They knew he had been sufficiently uncomfortable with the idea of another guy staying at St. Laurent's apartment that he had been there Friday night to check Rubright out. It was possible that if Amy St. Laurent was stuck without a ride in the Old Port, she might have called him to come pick her up. It was an outside possibility, since her mother was nearby in South Portland, and Sparrow lived more than an hour away in New Hampshire. But a jealous ex-boyfriend known to have been arguing with a missing person, could not be ignored. Sparrow told them that he had spent Saturday evening with friends, but that the friends had a small child, so it had been an early evening, and he had then returned to Newmarket, New Hampshire, where he was sharing an apartment with two female roommates. Detectives interviewed the couple he had spent the evening with, who confirmed Sparrow's version of the story. Then they went to New Hampshire and separately interviewed the two roommates, each of whom confirmed his timeline for late Saturday evening and for Sunday. On the basis of the information they had gathered and the timeline they'd made, they felt they could eliminate Richard Sparrow as a suspect. Just as they were checking the details of Eric Rubright's story, another major focus in this early stage of the investigation would be to test Russ Gorman's story by interviewing the residents of the Brighton Avenue apartment and witnesses such as bartenders, doormen, and customers who might have seen him with Amy St. Laurent at Foreplay, the Pavilion, or the Iguana, another Portland bar where police learned that Gorman, Kush Sharma, and Amy St. Laurent had stopped briefly so St. Laurent and Sharma could use the bathroom before driving to the Brighton Avenue apartment. On Wednesday, October 24th, police re-interviewed Gorman's roommates, Jason Cook and Kush Sharma. Sharma's story was essentially the same as Gorman's. He said Gorman had been gone only 20 or 25 minutes, then he was in for the rest of the night. That he, Sharma, and Jason Cook were sitting on couches watching TV when Gorman returned. That Gorman used the phone and then joined them. Sometime later, the other roommates, Dave Grazier and his fiancée, Dawn Shimrich, returned. Sharma also remembered that Dave Grazier had been at the apartment when Gorman first arrived with Amy, then left to go pick up Dawn. Jason Cook reported that he had been the manager at the Iguana Bar that evening and had left work at approximately 1:45 a.m., arriving back at the apartment between 1:45 and 2 a.m. He arrived as Gorman and Amy St. Laurent were leaving. Gorman introduced St. Laurent, and she wished Cook a happy birthday before she and Gorman left in Gorman's car. Cook told detectives that Gorman returned to the apartment about 20 minutes later. Cook stated that he was on the computer sending an email to his aunt in Florida when Gorman returned and that Gorman came in and asked to use the telephone to call his ex-girlfriend, Jamie. Gorman was seeking permission to use the phone because he wasn't a rent-paying tenant of the apartment. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.